What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
In the 1980s, detectives Hayes and West are frustrated with running down false leads and decide to get back to basics to do more thorough searches of the crime scene, to children's houses, and give further scrutiny to initial witnesses. They find that the children have been lying about their whereabouts, spending 3 to 4 days a week alone and unsupervised in the nearby woods. They also uncover a hidden cache of toys, some cryptic drawings, tiny handwritten notes of support and encouragement, and a photo of Will's first communion that looks suspiciously like his body was staged at the time of his death. In the 90s, Amelia and Wayne Hayes investigate the suddenly reopened Julie Purcell case together as journalist and detective. Amelia uses her feminine wiles to get information out of Oklahoma officers investigating the Walgreens break-in that Julie's prints were identified with, while Wayne loses his daughter in a local Walmart running errands. Wayne and Amelia have a fight seemingly over her flirtations with the cops and the careless way she talks about the case. Meanwhile, Wayne's old partner, Roland West, recruits him to be on the team investigating the reopened case. In 2015, Wayne learns of some apparently shoddy police work in the previous investigations, in particular, a failure to follow up on leads involving a mysterious scarred man in a suit, accompanied by a woman who drove around the area in a new brown sedan while questioning witnesses. He's later confronted by a vision of his now-deceased wife, Amelia, taunting him with paradoxes of time and space and cryptic warnings of him being forced to lose everything because of things he's left in the woods.
Welcome to The World We Deserve, the officially unofficial podcast for True Detective on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And we watched this week, Season 3, Episode 3, titled The Big Never. What'd you think of this one?
It's good. I really dig the three-level mystery you've got going on over all three decades. And I'm wondering, you know, we're going to be at the halfway point next week. How long can they maintain all three levels of that?
Without them bleeding into each other too
much. Right.
Like it's not long.
It seems like that we have to get somewhere in the 80s mystery, because there's an overturning of that in the 90s, which is mysterious, and then something nagging in 2015. But I don't know. But I was watching the kind of behind the scenes Pizzolatto interviews, and he said that like next week is really launching the 90s aspect of investigation, implying that maybe it's going to work itself from the middle out.
Okay, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
We got a little taste of that in this episode, right, with the drugstore stakeout and then the subsequent follow-up with the cops Amelia's part. So
yeah.
I could see that, being an interesting inroad to this investigation.
It's also interesting how they do, like, this weaved narrative shows the genesis, dissolution, ultimate destruction of Wayne and Amelia's relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you simultaneously see them falling in love and the issues with that, and those issues rearing their ugly head 10 years hence, and then, you know, the broken man has been left behind. I think that's really good, and it's allowing Mahershala and Mr. Dorf to do some excellent work.
Yeah. I was really struck by Mahershala's old man this episode.
Right. He had some choice when he was in the doctor's office. He had some choice.
Uh-huh. Good stuff. Even in his own private study, he was doing some really good stuff. Just with affecting the old man voice, which he kind of is doing with that character throughout the three time periods,
right,
but he adds a little extra spice to it.
Yeah.
In 2015. So I don't know. I'm blown away by his performance. And honestly, if he doesn't win, you know, some kind of Emmy gold somewhere, I'm going to be shocked.
Right. Have you seen the pop star Never Stopping?
I haven't.
Because I feel like he's throwing a little like Tim Meadows, now hold on there, young blood, kind of into the old man mix.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with his son. And I'm enjoying that.
Huh.
Okay. Should we talk about the episode proper?
I mean, the first thing to mention is that the board has officially started. The string board.
The string board, yes.
We got the initial volley of stuff up onto that board, and I was super excited to see that.
Yeah, I thought you said boar for a minute. I'm like, is this a reference to the hog farm? The boar's getting started? What?
Nope,
is this the Yellow King episode? There's a red boar? I don't know. right. But yeah, the red board has been started. A crazy yarn bar board.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. And it's got its first picture on it.
Mm. So, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I feel like I'm not picking up the thing you're pitching, but...
I'm just excited for the board. That's literally it.
All right. The board is on the board. Do we want to talk about the episode?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So we did like the 80s, 90s, 2015s last week. You want to continue with that?
Yeah, why not?
That mojo. Hey, before we get going on to the episode, I want to talk about some things going on here right at BaldMove.com this year week. On the BaldMove TV feeds, we're going to be wrapping up Punisher Season 2. We're going to be discussing the Fire documentaries that have been recently released on Netflix and Hulu, which I thought were a lot of fun. A lot of education, a lot of gloating, a lot of low stakes, nobody died feeling good about other people's misfortune, mm-hmm. kinda.
Yep.
On the Bald Movies feed, we've got a bunch of stuff. We got Glass last week. We've got Aquaman. We're going to go back and check out one that we missed over Christmas. We're going to be seeing the Netflix original Polar, based on a hit comic book starring Mads Mikkelsen, on the Bald Movies feed this week. Don't forget, it's the Baldies coming up next week. January 30th is our annual award show. This is our fifth annual. Nominations are now closed, but the winners voting will be open tomorrow. You can use the link baldies.baldmove.com starting tomorrow, January 23rd. So the ceremony will be released on January 30th. Show all the best comedies, dramas, actors, whatnot. And we also release all our deliberations, hours of, you know, transparency content where you actually find out why Jim and I voted the way we did. So that's kind of cool. We also have the second annual Not Quite Groundhog's Day, Groundhog's Day Marathon. You can find out more information at groundhog.baldmove.com. We're raising money for the National Alliance to End Homelessness. We're going to do a 24-hour stream. We're going to watch all of the Star Wars movies in chronological order Saturday, February 9th, from 12:01 a.m. to 11:59 p.m. I guess that's 23 hours and 58 minutes. We're going to be watching Star Wars and raising money. We raised over $10,000 last year. We'll see if we can do that good this year. It's going to be happening live at twitch.tv/baldmove. You can swing by. You can hang out with us. You can encourage us. You can watch some Star Wars with us. And hopefully you can throw some cash towards the homeless because they need it. So that's what's going on at baldmove.com. All right, so we begin in the 80s with them analyzing the note that they got last episode. The rant, kind of, it's not a ransom note. It's a, you know, kid should be happy note. They're analyzing for fingerprints and other details. They mention that there's some like childlike aspects or naive aspects to the operation, like the fact that they went to all this trouble to do the ransom style note from all the different clippings, but they hand wrote the envelope.
Yeah, that's an interesting detail that I don't think is thrown out there just to show how dumb the perpetrators are.
Mm.
I think it's going to tie back in, but we'll maybe talk about that when we get to the notes.
I wonder if the implication is like the child. Because there's all these crazy theories about like maybe the kids kidnapped themselves, whatnot. Like, are one of the things we're supposed to believe is maybe that this is the child herself? Like sending a note saying, but she, the parents would recognize her handwriting, right?
Yeah. So that's the kind of where I'm going with this. Like, they have the handwriting of someone involved in this kidnapping.
Right.
They're
but it's
also
not immediately obvious or connecting to anything.
Well, no, you're right. It's not. The show does not connect it. However, there's one other instance of handwriting being found in this episode, which is the notes that were found in Julie's stuff.
Yeah.
That's all we can really say conclusively.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that those two things would be introduced at the same time.
Right.
And we don't see the envelope, so we don't get a good look at the handwriting.
Right.
But if I had to guess,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to say those probably match.
Yeah. And I don't know, because like, you think so?
I think those probably match.
Interesting.
That's
interesting.
My wild theory for the week.
Like, but why wouldn't that immediately jump out to, you know, Purple Haze, the man tracker?
I don't think he's seen him.
He hasn't seen the notes?
No, the envelope.
Oh, the envelope.
I don't know that he's seen the envelope, because in that scene, he seems to be getting caught up on this stuff.
But him, I think him and Roland went to the guy's house when he got it, and like I don't know. That's I think.
But they got a call from somebody else,
okay,
saying, "Hey, we got this note."
I thought they showed up and had, but I don't know. I could be wrong about that. That's my only skepticism. I felt like that Hayes had seen the note or had at least, you know, seen it entered into custody, and he would have been like, hey, these handwritings are similar.
He saw the note. I don't know if he saw the envelope.
Right. So we found also something that's complicating matters is the Ozark Charity Outreach offering $10,000 tip reward, which took the already kind of runaway small town speculation and added
Mars
10,000 1980s US dollars to it.
Right.
So you get people calling with angelic visions and things happening on Mars, apparently, and it's really turned the investigation to a mockery. So Wayne kind of like has this idea to, like, let's get back down to basics and run down some of these inconsistencies in the story. One of them that they want us to pay attention to is the little kid having a new dog and not really be like, oh, I guess I said they could come over sometime, but
yeah.
And it's revealed in the episode that I guess the Purcells had made out like they're going to this kid's house all the time.
Yeah, three, four times a week.
And they're not. They're just going and fucking around someplace else, and no one knows, not even their parents.
I mean, likely in the woods?
Likely in the woods, yeah. As we'll find out, right? So that's kind of interesting that they... I feel it paints a certain picture of... Tim, is it Tim or Tom Purcell? Tom, right?
Yeah.
Of him just barely functioning as a parent. You know, like, if these kids are not causing them problems, they're bright kids, they're not having problems in school, if they're not setting things on fire, he's content to let them do whatever the hell they want without any kind of, like, kind of follow-up.
Yeah. It's just probably, yeah, fairly safe in the 80s.
Right. So they request to kind of go through the house with a finer tooth comb, and they find, Roland finds a couple of, like, a cache of, like, artwork that includes a drawing. It's like, to me, it looked like a D&D map, but it also had, like, topographical settings and whatnot. Yeah. It has, like, a drawing of a castle, some kind of, like, kitchen type of room in crayon. And he finds a bunch of these little notes. They're on little tiny paper squares that says stuff like, I'm always here, don't listen, always keep you safe, stuff like that. They also find a Hoyt food apron, which this seemed like a big stretch to me because she had worked there. How many?
Yeah, two years ago. One, 2 years ago.
Yeah, like... Boy, I mean, I guess you at this point you follow up on anything since you don't have any real leads. But I felt like that's the one thing that, like, wow, you find this kind of rolled up in here, and like, let's go see what's under Hoyt's dirty fingernails. I guess the other connection is that the charity is connected to.
Yeah, but they never say that in the episode.
No,
they only tell you that when they show up. At
right.
The charity.
It's something you have to pay attention to and know that this place they're going to is also the place that was the Ozark outreach program and all that.
And you mentioned being rolled up. I want to note that the notes look like they've been really tightly folded up.
Yeah,
at some point
there. I'll
come into play later, my crazy theories.
Okay, let's, because I kind of want to, the crazy theory is that someone, like, they want you to think that the hole between in the closet is some kind of creepy thing on behalf of the brother, more likely the uncle.
Yeah.
But why else would you drill a small hole and have very tiny rolled notes of encouragement and support?
Yeah. I don't know, maybe your parents are screaming and shouting at each other in the background, and you're perhaps
you've been told to go to your room.
An uncular-esque visitor?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that handwriting is way too good for the boy, right?
You think so?
I don't know. He's 12.
Because, like, if the boy drew, maybe the boy's the Boy Scout, he drew that map, which has no, like, you know, like, it's kind of like what a scout would draw for a D&D campaign, right? I feel like, and him being described
maybe,
as kind of like thoughtful, meticulous.
The other possibility is the uncle.
It could be the uncle. And so he's not creepy. He's actually genuinely supportive.
Right.
I still think he's creepy, but the two aren't mutually exclusive, I guess.
Yeah, that's a weird relationship to have. And, you know, we've thrown around the idea that maybe uncle is bio dad.
Oh, right. Which would make it creepy, but not towards the little girl necessarily.
Right. And I could see a situation.
As creepy as first cousins fucking is, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. There's so much to talk about around just the notes and who could have done it and the uncle and what his involvement could be.
Tasty.
I don't even know where to start. The notes are a good inroad, but it doesn't end there. Like,
oh, how deep do you want to go, Jim?
I mean, we got to pretty much talk about all of it, right?
All right. Spool it out. I can tell you want to run with this.
So if the uncle is the person passing the notes,
all right,
and
granted.
You know, he's doing it to, like, yeah, this is an assumption, but he's doing it because, you know, the daughter is frightened at her parents' relationship and he's trying to comfort her. Maybe he's the biological dad. Maybe he's not. It doesn't really matter, but he might see the situation and go, I need to get her out of this.
Mm.
And could eventually lead to
the only flaw,
either him,
the boy must go.
Well, I have a theory on that too.
Oh,
I don't think he killed the boy. I don't think anybody killed the boy. I think the boy just died. I
think he fell onto the sharp rocks.
Yeah, it seemed like it. I mean, somebody could have smashed his head on there, but yeah, I'm getting a vibe like the uncle was trying to protect her and maybe did some things, hired some people or did it himself.
The Fargo situation, mistakes were made, things went wrong.
The only thing that I have that really nags at me is, like, would the uncle be able to drive up like 3-4 times a week to play with these kids in the woods? If he was the one,
and not have anyone know about it,
that and even just the logistics of doing it, right?
Yeah.
With a full-time job,
right?
Like, the kids were leaving right after school, so is he not, like, working? What's his deal?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's not consistent with the mysterious figure that the show is acknowledging, which is the scarred white suit man and his
Mr. Bojangles.
Lady.
Yeah,
Mr. Bo. Wow. Okay. You're up on all the conspiracy theories I see.
Sure. Yeah. No, I read a lot about the West Memphis 3 last week.
Okay. So can we get back to the regular narrative and we'll take these theories as they come? So they go to Hoyt Foods, which is looks like a chicken and pig kind of meat processing center. And the Borg voted to contribute some tip money because Lucy, the mother, had been a chicken line lady 2 years hence, which, again, I guess I can see, because, you know, these small local town foundations, they are big about the community working for them 2 years ago might mean something. And they also dropped that the company founder experienced the loss of his grandchildren recently, which is why the foundation was formed. And the company principal's kind of taken aback when the detectives say, oh, yeah, we're going to need the names and dates of everyone you've hired before or since Lucy worked here. But they're going to cooperate. They also dropped that Mr. Hoyt is something of a hunter himself and has been on safari since mid-October. There is, are you up on the theories that say that the Hoyts are doing some kind of reverse raising Arizona? That they are replacing the loss of their grandchildren with the Purcells, and things kind of went amiss.
I haven't read that theory specifically, but I've seen some stuff that I consider spoilers that I don't want to talk about.
Okay. Because here's the thing, like, these are these class of like, they're not even really theories. They're like, I bet this is what's going to happen. And it has like one or two supporting facts. And the thing that it's got going for it is there is a nice narrative symmetry between the hunter of man going against, you know, the other hunter, like the big game safari guy going against the most dangerous safari guy. That would be a kind of interesting conclusion, but it's more of like a literary need for, wouldn't it be cool for that to happen? Than like, look at all this evidence that's stacked up here. But there you go. We then also see, going back to kind of like basic police work, they've recruited volunteers to just manually hike in like search formation, arms abreast, all 2,500 acres of this park, the Devil's Den.
I don't understand how this works. So he claims that like the standard procedure is to start from, you know, close by and work your way out, which I get it. That makes a lot of sense. But it seems like the manpower is dwindling as the days creep on.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you want to take the most people you're ever going to have working on this investigation and stick them kind of far out so you can cover as much ground as possible?
It just depends if you're going to leave gaps. Cause I guess it's,
I guess you probably have to,
cause it's probably like, you know, a lot of this missing people stuff is just percentages. Like every day past the first, they're less likely to live every mile they get past. So it's like, kind of makes sense to keep it like at an epicenter, especially kids when they're probably on foot. But so it's like, I don't know. Like, now it's one thing if a Purple Haze goes out there and finds a bent fucking twig, then yeah, they ought to get the all 100 of those people walking in that direction. Fuck the procedures, but
yeah, assuming he even tells them about the bent twig.
Right, right. He just might pocket it after he licks it and and swabs his pee hole with it. Maybe this is the poor evidence handling is what torpedoed the case in the 80s. I'm wondering
because I'm not actually sure that he's shown these notes to anyone.
I was about to say this. Yeah, there's a lot of, like, I mean, it's weird because, number one, we got a character who has fallible memory.
Uh-huh.
And number two, they've done instances where you see the guy, like you know, maybe you think Wayne pockets those corn silk things, but then later they're presented in the evidence. Or, like, right. They don't ever show him take this backpack full of shit and be like, hey, partner, look at his backpack. And then it just, like, later on it shows up half-cataloged even. And that's funny, too, because people are on Reddit like, my God, the configuration of toys is different. And I'm like, I think you're supposed to assume that half of them are in the little brown bags with evidence numbers and stuff, and it's like in the like, right? Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, probably.
Not every little thing is a hint, but, you know.
But these notes specifically, like, don't we see them later in the episode in, like, folded into a notebook
I thought it was in a case file, though.
Was it? I can't quite remember. Might have been.
But maybe you're right, because I know, here's the thing, I know, because, Roland found it, right? And then we see Wayne later looking at it. So, like, I don't think it's just if
no, Wayne found the notes.
Oh, I thought it was Roland. Mm-hmm. He was the one in the girls' room. Okay.
I don't think so, because I remember Mahershala pocketing them.
Okay.
When he finds them.
So the other thing that happens in the set piece is you get the little bit of the courtship of Wayne and Amelia, and they are. The only thing I think that the attraction here is they both sense that they're impressive people of substance, but they have
attractive people.
Yeah. They are both very attractive. Yeah. Amelia was given a chance to be very sexy in this episode, and she succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
Their life philosophy seem to be very, very different. How they look at things, how they view basic things like war and society and literature, even.
Yeah.
Politics. You know, she's a radical Black Panther and he's probably a Black Republican. I don't know. It's easy to see storm clouds, but there is this kind of like, yeah, but there's something fierce about these people too that I think attracts that kind of fire attracts each other.
Yeah, and honestly, when I look at these scenes, you know, of them kind of combing the fields there, I get a sort of trepidation on her part mostly,
because
like,
right.
What am I getting myself into here? Like, I am attracted to this person, but they are very different from me.
And she's still dating a guy, right?
And I think, yeah, she still has a boyfriend.
I mean, I see so much analysis talking about her being uncomfortable and shifty, and I'm like, she's kind of two-timing, like, she's in the early stages of two-timing her boyfriend.
Right.
I don't think she's crossed a line, but he asked her out.
Especially not the murder and kidnapping line. Like, everybody is so on this theory of, like, Amelia did it. Look how she's reacting to all these questions. She's reacting like a woman who isn't sure that she actually wants to date this person.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't know where this relationship is going. Doesn't know if it should go anywhere. Uh-huh. And she's trying to feel that out.
Right.
That's what I'm getting from those scenes.
Right. And he asks her out at some point in this episode. And so I think that, like, now, like, she's either broken up with this dude or she's officially entered two-timing status. Yeah. Or maybe there's roommates. I don't know what their deal is.
maybe they're...
He's also drives
an adoptive brother and sister. I don't know.
Yeah. He also drives a shiny brown sedan. So fair enough. He's also a prime suspect in the murder mystery.
Who does?
Her boyfriend.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. Maybe they got it wrong. It's a white scarred man in a suit and a black lady. They just got the races switched.
That's the fallible memory thing, huh?
That's right. They also in Wayne's you know, journeying across this park, he finds like some D&D style dice with a cache of children's toys in like some kind of backpack or satchel.
Mm-hmm.
And by D&D style dice, I mean dice that have more or less than six sides.
Yeah.
But it's got, I don't know, it's got like there's a teddy bear and a doctor's play doctor kit and a Han Solo and Leia action figures from Star Wars, and some of these corn silk dolls are spread around. He also finds these sharp, jagged rocks that has some conspicuous blood stains on it. And then he finds a nearby gravel road that leads to this two-story house, which is in the middle of nowhere, which leads to an interview. The man there claims that a man with a badge talked to him and said that he saw a car patrolling out here a couple of times, and there's a man and a woman. But then they want to search a house, and he goes, fuck no, this is America. I got my rights, and throws them out on their ass.
Yeah, good. Good for him.
Do you think they're going to get a warrant?
So from my recollection of the scene, it does seem like they got a warrant, because there's a like an establishing shot of the farmhouse with like a whole bunch of cops parked out there, an FBI and all sorts of stuff. And it's the scene where they kind of lay everything out on the hood of the car review the evidence.
I guess I'd taken that like they had were just like showing the other cops all the shit they'd found in the woods. But we took another look at that scene, and you're right. There's like FBI there, and like the place is just swarming. I don't know if they got a warrant and they've actually gone in, or they've gone in and they didn't turn up anything. All of the evidence we presented so far, nothing. It doesn't seem like anything of interest has come from that search, if that search has happened at this point.
Yeah, or we haven't been privy to it.
There's one Reddit theory I want to point out that I saw, where a lot of people are very excitedly pointing out that there's some similarities between the drawing that Julie has of this kitchen looking and this like this man's kitchen that we're talking about searching.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're similar in the loosest possible way to say they're similar,
which is to say, like, almost every American kitchen has these things in it.
Honestly,
a countertop, a window, a fridge.
Right. And honestly,
and they're different in far more ways than they are similar.
And some person pointed out it could even be a garage. Like that could be like a tool bench, not because it looks like it's almost like an island kind of thing. And
an island. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think. And the people are like, well, of course they're not the same. It's a child's recollection. Like, I don't think that's the way Pizzolatto is going to do us. Like, if this was, it would be a cruder version of what would be in reality. But like, I don't know. I mean,
the drawing of that room is a much more modern kitchen. If you look at it, like the farmhouse kitchen, it doesn't have upper cabinets. It doesn't have like an island in it at all.
Mm-hmm.
The backsplash is completely different. There's clutter everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, this kid would not remember that this was a cluttered place and try and draw like fucking forks and spoons or something.
Yeah,
like,
I don't know.
But here's the thing: the backsplash looks very modern. The layout looks very modern. I would say if it's anybody, it's somebody with some money, which actually leads itself back into like the Hoyt
connection. Yeah.
That idea. Like, I haven't seen the uncle's kitchen, but I seriously doubt it looks this modern.
When you say modern, you're talking about 1980s, right?
Yeah, I mean, by the 1980s standards, yeah.
Okay.
Like,
all right.
Having an island in your kitchen and having, like, a subway tile backsplash is, like, a super modern thing for that time.
Okay. So we then go to see the Native American Vietnam veteran Woodward getting jumped by some guys in his little go-kart trailer that accuse him of creeping around their kids. And he points out, I'm a father myself, which they deny. He then tries to put up the defense, I fought for your rights, you fucking assholes, as they're pulling him from his vehicle and beating him. He actually does a pretty good account of himself. Like, he handles like two or three of these guys, and before they overwhelm him and pull a gun on him and warn him that if they see him around here again, they'll kill him.
Mm-hmm.
This is some not cool shit, man. I felt really bad for this guy last episode. Now it's like, holy, like, take all the stigma of being a Vietnam vet in this era, and now add being a Native American and having these assholes jumping you to it.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
It's a tough scene to watch.
Yeah.
Frankly.
And it's going to go dark places, because we see Woodward later in the episode go back and angrily retrieve a cache of gun-sized duffel bag from his
a young girl's body-sized duffel bag.
If this Indian killed any of these kids,
that's so not true.
I will be so fucking pissed.
Yeah, it clearly had guns and ammo in it.
Yeah, I think it looks like a Frank Castle Punisher special that he's retrieving, and he's going to serve out some of these hillbillies. But fine, I don't know. We'll have to see.
Yeah.
I hope someone stops him, because if he does, he's probably going to get the death penalty.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like there is no just outcome for this course of action. I don't think. So the police do what you'd naturally expect them to do: take some photos of these toys back to the parents and ask them if they can identify. And Tom, who identifies himself as the toy buyer of the family, he's a shitty father, because two children together cannot have between the two of them at least a Han Solo or a Leia
in
the year 1980 at the start of Star Wars. What the fuck? This is borderline child abuse.
Yeah. Maybe they have like the Millennium Falcon. He just wouldn't buy him the play figures.
Right. You buy him the vehicles and the play sets and just use your imagination.
Right. Make some corn cob dolls.
You get a corn cob Luke and here's a corn cob Han. And Hayes is meanwhile looking at a baby book and a bombshell happens. There's a picture of Will at his first baptism. Or communion?
His communion, yeah. First communion.
And he's clutching a rosary, and he's got his finger steepled in his death pose position from the cave last episode. And this obviously is a very exciting idea to the detectives, because it looks like whoever killed him had to have some kind of connection to him in a familial kind of way.
Yeah, or maybe some broader just religious commonalities.
That's true.
That's possible.
This is why I'm a terrible detective, because I just leap to conclusion no, at each of new evidence.
I'm absolutely with you. I think it was someone who had at least seen that photo.
Yeah.
And, you know, the uncle would certainly have access to that photo over the time he spent in the place. Yeah, it's super interesting. And I think, like, they almost didn't need that big crazy flashback that they do with Mahershala's eyes being as wide as the moons that maybe don't exist.
Right.
I thought it was a little much, because, look, we just watched this last week. It's not like this was five episodes ago.
Right. Oh, speaking of moons, this weekend was the Super Wolf Blood Moon.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what any of those words mean except for moon. It was a full eclipse. Like a fucking blood wolf moon? What is this?
I know what super means.
Did I wake up in the Warhammer universe or some shit? Is there an elder god that's going to come through? What the fuck? Yeah. It was super, super cool, though. And I don't know. I was hoping for a little bit of a crazy moon connection in True Detective. Didn't get it. This is the one week that the moon acted relatively sane. Thank you very much. Shall we move into the 90s, Jim?
Okay.
A decade which I think you're a little bit more at home in.
Yeah. I was 8 years old in that year.
This is your turf. So Wayne and Amelia are outside the Walgreens in Oklahoma that was broken into. And she's talking and trying to talk him into making this vacation into like a sex and a sexy times junket.
Why not?
And he's like not having it even a little bit. Like there's a little grim, mirthless, like, oh, wouldn't that be nice? But like, yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Look at your wife over there, man.
She's hot.
Pumped out two kids and keeping it tight. What the fuck?
I get
some marital aids here in Walgreens and go to the Hampton Inn. Jesus. Yes, Jim.
Marital aids at Walgreens? Do they sell those?
Marital aids?
Yeah.
I mean, lubrication's a marital aid, right? Condoms?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
French ticklers.
Those are kind of your baseline marital aids.
You can get like a bullet vibe in there, right?
Nah, in a Walgreens in 1990.
Anything's a sex toy if you're brave enough, Jim.
Right, they sell cans of Pringles. Let's go to town. So I love the way that they're parked here, because you have to remember that this is a place that was just robbed, like not very long ago at all. And now they're sitting in the parking lot, parked over six spots with their lights off, staring right into the front doors.
Right.
The employees must be like, oh shit, it's happening again.
That's right.
Having flashbacks in there, shutting shit down,
right.
Hunkering in with shotguns and pistols.
Right. Right. There's two shady looking black people in our parking lot.
Right.
And we're trying to close. Come save us, officers.
Second, I think they actually do end up going to the motel and boning at the end.
They both.
That's how I read.
The boning? You read boning in that?
I read motel bone zone.
Interesting. She mentions in this scene too, like, she's like, hey, like, what if I, like, not really seduce, but what if I, you know, play up my sexy writer? Oh, you're such a strong cop and I need you for a source, kind of. She Amy Adams, she wants Amy Adams the cops in Oklahoma, except for without the furtive, fully clothed boning. You guys ought to watch Sharp Objects to get a lot of these jokes.
Yeah.
I think if you like this show, you'll love Sharp Objects. Go back and watch it. It's on HBO. Thank me later. I felt like that they were kind of both on board with that idea. Like, oh, okay, this is kind of sexy and fun. But for whatever reason, Wayne later is way against it. Did you think that kind of jealousy came out of nowhere?
Oh, way against her going and flirting with these cops to get info.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a little weird. I was like, what the hell? Why are you acting this way toward a woman who is simply doing her job. Like, do you think, is there some history with you two where, like, she's cheated on you before and this is, like, beyond the pale that she would even consider doing this or what? Like, his reaction is so out of proportion.
Well, I know one thing that happens is the experience at Walmart, it's a big week for Walls. The experience at Walmart, like, where he lost track of his daughters, and it seemed like he was maybe resentful that he's having to do this kind of woman stuff because she was out doing her black heart-to-heart routine.
Yeah.
I thought maybe that's what, like, he was just, like, angry at himself for losing track of his daughter. And people have pointed out that this was, like, a real hysterical time in America about, like, you know, kids being abducted. This was, like, when the Adam... You know, the Code Adam, like, we're like four or 5 years before Code Adam being instituted, which is, like, you know, the Walmart policy of locking down the store, essentially doing what Wayne wanted them to do in this episode. Mm-hmm. Whenever there's a kid being lost, this was an Adam Walsh, the American's most wanted guy, got abducted from a Sears. There was kind of a rash of this. It was a like a moral panic in the United States. So like his loss of control in this situation and knowing what can happen with kids, like, maybe that, like, you're not supposed to see this as, like, real relational friction, but, like, an extreme, like, PTSD reaction that like a hypervigilant guy like Wayne would have to his child being gone. That's because otherwise it just seems like he's a fucking mean asshole.
It does. And some of it is probably feeling a little, maybe impotent in this situation, like his inability to get this information that his wife is getting, kind of the role reversal there might feel a little weird to him. But yeah, that certainly experience with his kids is the major driver.
I thought it was really cool. The actual Walmart set.
Yeah.
Like, it looked very much like kind of small town, early 90s Walmart. Like, they had a very, like, it, and it's so funny to hear him being like, this store is way too big. Like, wait until a Super Walmart rolls into town, dude. Wait till you get a load of a Sam's Club,
Costco,
man.
Yeah.
You have no idea what's coming.
I thought it was cool that they kind of shot Walmart as, like, a horror film for about a minute.
Like, it's, I tell you what, like, it's happened to me once where Jack, when he was, like, three or four, got, like, I turned my bag and he was gone in a department store. And it's, like, fucking white hot electrical fear. And those aisles just are designed to hide children in. You know,
and you weren't even working a case.
No, hell no. I don't.
Child abduction.
Yeah, I don't swim in child abductions for my job. Well, I guess kind of I do.
Yeah,
like, I bet. Yeah. You know what? I have as much experience as this fake fictional cop. I've been through three seasons of True Detective. Yeah. I've been through Sharp Objects. I've been I'm familiar with the criminal milieu. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. At least as much as this fictional cop is. So Amelia does have some success buttering up these cops. She comes equipped with a sheer white dress and she's got her headlights turned on to the bright setting. And these guys are, like, in her personal space and want to take her out for a beer. And
I looked, and I got to say, you know, despite them wanting to ask her out for a beer and divulging a bunch of information because she's an attractive woman, being attractive and sexy. Not once did I detect them looking down at her breasts.
Really? I wasn't
fucking
looking.
Fucking blew my mind. I was like, oh, this is the first thing they're going to do.
Yeah,
these dirty pervs.
Especially night, you know, like, they're still smoking in offices in this era. So, like,
not once.
Yeah, I
not
thought.
Not once. Blown away.
I was semi, and this shows what, like, what little we expect out of men, but I was kind of semi impressed there wasn't, like, her having to fend off a hand on the ass or something.
Right.
But it was all exactly kind of like, you know, it was kind of fun and sexy, and there's this big smile on her face because this is going exactly to plan, and, you know, it's always cute when that works out. So she comes home, and he's saying, you know, she catches him reading her manuscript, and he complains that he can't really get into it because he sees his name in it, and he just picks a fight with her. We talked about this.
I guess I don't quite understand what his hang up about him being in that book is.
Some people said, I saw one compelling theory that they mentioned that he's dyslexic. And that this is actually cover for him struggling to read lengthy material.
Did they mention that? I must have missed it.
He said something about, like, they made some mention about the word, like, the letters kind of getting jumbled up, and when he was talking about school or, like, so I wonder if this is kind of underlying sensitivity to that, and it's kind of an excuse, but I don't know.
Could be.
And they get in a fight, and she tells him, like, look, I'm not going to stop being this investigative journalist that I've turned into. And I, like I said, that's the other thing. I felt like that this is not a sign of long-term marital strife. It's more like a short-term annoyance, because this didn't feel like a fight that's been brewing or happening. Like, she seemed genuinely shocked and angry about his accusations and behavior. So,
whereas you look at the contrast of Tom and his wife, that's been brewing for a while.
Right, right. Yeah, that's been bubbling over. I think the coffee pot's broke and shattered. there's a couple of the scenes that we've skipped over where Roland is talking to the district attorney, Glenn, I think is his name. And like in the 90s, they're having this kind of like powwow. And he mentioned a couple of things I thought were interesting. Number one, that you all fucked a good detective back then. You know that, right?
Yeah.
And the reasonable kind of silver haired Fox lawyer says, I ain't going to dispute that. I mean, they're talking about Wayne somehow.
Gotta be. Yeah. My interpretation of all this with everything I've seen from this episode is that something went down during this case.
Yeah.
Wayne was very vocal about how he's getting fucked, or like how they fucked up this investigation or something.
Right.
And it's all their fault. And I think that Roland gets shot at some point.
Yeah, he mentions like, yeah, if I had been the one that screwed up and got shot, maybe.
Yeah. And so I think like he got some sort of promotion based off of that. You know, like, hey, you took a bullet in the field and you were doing good detective work. It didn't work out. The case, you know, was blown or whatever. But
right,
that's my impression. Like, you know, obviously Wayne got left behind. Roland got promoted.
Right. I mean, it's the getting shot. It's the being white. It's
right. Absolutely.
And then there's a couple others. Like, so, you know, Roland points out, it's like, also, I kept my mouth shut more often, which, you know, that's a pretty bad 1-2-3 punch.
Yeah.
If you're, I guess, you're competing for promotions. And they also, they ask him that he and Roland had a, or him and Wayne had a falling out, and he goes, well, he doesn't deny it. And he goes, I can't really rightly say why. He goes, once we stopped working together, we just stopped, which, I mean, I can totally relate to that. Like, there's a lot of people I consider good friends with at work, and then you switch jobs and sometimes, most of the time you don't stay in touch. Like, this didn't feel like nefarious or... And even later when the two men meet, that doesn't seem to be that much bad blood between them. Mm-hmm. So
no, I think Wayne's grudge is basically over how the
system
police force handled the aftermath of everything. And Roland, you know, is maybe not to blame in that, but he gets caught up in the blame game, I guess, in Wayne's head.
Yeah. The other thing that Amelia found out when she's buttering up the cops was that Julia's fingerprints... Well, they don't really know, but they only found them in like in the cosmetic aisle. There weren't on any of the entrances. Now, the cops also didn't do a thorough job because they wanted to hustle up and get the store reopened. But it led Amelia to believe that like maybe Julia wasn't part of the robbery. She just was, you know, happened to have her prints there. Wrong place, wrong time kind of thing.
Yeah.
So Roland visits Tom Purcell, who has cleaned himself up and
5 years sober.
Yeah, he's winning the 10-year challenge, and he's got like he's in a nicer house, everything, and it looks like he's found Jesus, and this is a big part of his acceptance of all this stuff. But obviously, honestly, worked up and you know, kind of excited, scared, nervous, optimistic, dreading what this means to find his daughter alive after all these years, and he asks Roland to pray with him.
Which seems sort of uncomfortable for Roland. Not like super uncomfortable, not like asking Russ Cole to pray with you.
Yeah.
But like kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah. Because Russ would be like, which God are we praying to? I know Hindu prayer that involves excarnation of flesh and
6 days of sex.
Exactly.
It'll blow your mind. I do have to say, most of the uncomfortableness around this, I think, was kind of looking over and seeing all the things that are going through Tom's head at any given point, right? Like, help me not to, you know, grow too attached to anything in this world. Help me to, like, avoid all of these other traits that you know, he deals with that are maybe less than desirable.
Mm-hmm.
which, you know, it seems like he's handling them, but I think that's what Roland's looking over, like, oh boy, this is what's in your head.
Oof. Well, no, that but does not describe the, I mean, these are very driven, attached to things, men, like, you know, I think it's also kind of a rebuke to their maniacal way of life too.
Sure.
So we then we see back at the police office that Hayes gets a message that a lieutenant wants to see him, and we find out that this lieutenant is none other than Roland, who meets him at the local VFW post, I believe. And there's some jibes, like he, you know, Hayes opens with kind of like the racial resentment about joke, you know, it's not even a joke, it's just an observation, and they kind of get into sparring, but. Mm-hmm. You feel like there's still some, there's not a lot of bad blood, more like lingering mutual respect, and Roland offers him a job on this new task force that's formed to find a real killer.
And he takes it.
And he takes it. So then we flash forward to 2015, and we're at a doctor's office with Wayne and his son, and he's getting results. They're not saying what he's got. They're like, whether it's Alzheimer's or dementia, whether it's some kind of Parkinson's, they're not really, they're hinting that it's like an obvious diagnosis that like Wayne's not wanting to hear, but they don't come right out and say it. There's some really good acting, some old cantankerous man acting here. Mm-hmm. The whole, you know, like babies don't remember anything. It's like, it's nice that we have to revisit this phase on the way out.
Yeah, and then, you know, when they start playing the gotcha game, he gets pissed about that, and says, hey, I'm going to kill myself. You put me in a home.
You put me in a home, I'm going to off myself, just so you know that.
I mean, I guess that's what the gun is for,
I got the toenail clippers ready to go.
Like, if this is the day where the men in white coats come for you.
Right, yeah, if you need it.
Reach for that nightstand.
Yeah, yeah. And I also like, but it's the listener, he sounds like he's full of shit, because he's like, look, at the why were we at the burnt out Purcell's house? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't remember, but at the time, I knew what I was doing. I just can't remember what it was. Like,
right.
Okay.
Then, do you remember knowing what you were doing? Because then you would have to remember what it was, right? Yeah.
Maybe you're not remembering the fact you were in a fugue state for the whole, and just like, you know, weaving from side to side of the road, like Leonardo DiCaprio in Wolf of Wall Street. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, the gotcha game, you know, He's resentful of having this disease, is what it is. Like, sure. He is angry
at all these things being taken from him.
He's losing himself. So,
and he's lost things he doesn't remember, like you know, his daughter, his wife, his old life. It's not only has he lost it in real life, but now he's even being deprived of memories.
Yeah, no, it's a sad scene, honestly, sure. And you know, it's tinged with anger, but as you would expect.
So he's being interviewed by the young journalist lady, and she's confronting him with some uncomfortable facts about the investigation that he might not be fully aware of or doesn't remember himself. So he insists that they did a thorough job canvassing the neighborhood, but she has statements from multiple neighbors saying that not only were they not interviewed multiple times, they never got interviewed. And it seems like that these people also have a singular narrative about this black man with scars wearing a suit and this white woman that he's with and his brown, shiny new late model sedan. Mm-hmm. And this kind of triggers something in him because he murmurs the word treads. And we see the flashback, him seeing his tread. So like, this is triggering a memory that he had. But like, a lot of this stuff, it's implying that there is a cover up that was maybe over his head. That this DA arranging detectives and had private people working on it that were compartmentalizing things from Roland and Wayne here. And he tries to get her done. It's like, so what new evidence do you have? And the son gets testing. They cancel the interview. They also talk about in his study, he's I think this is a lampshading or it's like throwing a bucket of cold water in this kind of theory, which is the satanic panic D&D stuff, because he addresses this in like his reminiscing with his tape recorder. Like, a lot of people thought these games would get people killed playing them or something. And so I feel like that's Pizzolatto's way of saying this isn't what this is about.
Right, by coming out and explicitly saying it.
Right, and like this and the Memphis 3 and all that. Like, these are things I'm riffing with, but they're not what the story I'm trying to tell. Then the ghost of Amelia shows up and says a whole bunch of cryptic shit about some real Rick and Morty shit, man, about infinite possibilities, and Einstein saying the present and the future and the past are all an illusion. and that you have to harden your heart about the things that you want to lose most, and that you have to lose everything. And she also, he also frets about losing Becca, and she goes, "You have, but not in the way you think." And then she also taunts him with, "Worried about what you'll find, what you left in the woods, that you need to finish this."
Yeah,
and this along... really, this really, I can't sell how much this disturbs Wayne.
Yeah,
this scare. This is it. He's like, "Oh no!" He starts sounding like what is it? The character from The Matrix. Switch or something. Not like this. Not my dead wife coming back.
Yeah.
It's like, "Elizabeth, I was coming to you. Now you're coming to me. This is really confusing. I don't like it." Okay, you got some analysis, Jim.
Oh, I mean, along with like all of the stuff that he's pocketing in this episode, I'm starting to think, like, did he perhaps unknowingly help with the cover-up? Like, was he complicit in this case not getting solved the way it should have been?
And because of, like, now
he can't remember, you know, the pieces that they might find later that point to that.
The only thing I can think of is that, and I don't know if this is true or not, I saw it asserted a couple places, that, like, evidence collecting was fundamentally not as good in the 80s as it was even in the 90s.
I would buy that, yeah.
Before the crucials of, like, DNA evidence and contamination and all that. So, like, I wonder if we are Pizzolatto's trying to accurately portray, like, gumshoe work in the 80s, whereas we're, like, conditioned to NCIS and CSI. Right. And we're like, where are
the
rubber gloves?
The scene. Yeah,
where are, like, the tweezers? Where is the grid? Where is the little plastic baggies? I mean, they don't even use plastic.
They don't, yeah.
They use paper baggies. So, like, I wonder if there is a little that he's trying to be authentic and we're reading this as sloppy police work.
Yeah, which, no, I agree.
Yeah. It's a good hypothesis anyway.
And I don't think that precludes the idea that you could look back on that as a
and
failing.
Say, oh, God,
like,
what if?
Oh, I fucked up.
Sure,
you
sure.
Know? Like, if we had had this tool, or if I had done things the way we do things now,
yeah,
we might have solved this.
Oh, I mean, we're in that era right now. Like, if you got a 30-year-old cold case, there's probably lots of times where it's like, oh, Jesus, if we had handled these samples, or even taken the samples that we would have today, we would have nailed this guy, or we would have, mm-hmm, you know, set this other guy free. Shit, we see that happen all the time.
And with the faulty memory, I mean, it seems, yes, like there's a lot of room to say, hey, what did Wayne do here that he would be worried subconsciously about them finding out?
Right, right. That's all I have on the episode. We have a ton of feedback this week. Did you got anything you want to talk about?
Okay. No, I think we pretty much covered everything.
And before we get to feedback, I'd like to talk to you about the club at club.baldmove.com. Because like 90s-era Walmart, we're offering everyday low prices on our club. And packed with features. Now with 33% more features by volume, not weight.
It's single or double ply?
It's triple ply.
Ooh.
But it's,
damn,
it's actually made out of compressed plywood. So when we say triple ply, it's three times the plywood, three times the sensitive skin being scraped. But on the plus side, you get ad-free feeds. You get VIP access to the forums. You get video versions of most of our podcast. You get tons of extra features like Lunch with Jim and Aaron, spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews, tons of other features. You can preview them all by going to club.baldmove.com. You can actually get to see examples of all this stuff in a full pitch. And you can try 30 days, your money back if you don't like it, by going to club.baldmove.com and signing up today. Okay, you can send feedback to truedetective@baldmove.com. We also have an episode thread on the forums, forums.baldmove.com. If you'd like to talk with your fellow fans there, let's get to the first feedback. Josh says, some of this stuff is about the first two episodes. I can't help thinking that Robert Penn Warren poem Amelia reads in class, "Tell Me a Story," is a key for the theme of the season, particularly the line, "The name of the story will be time." If it's perfectly how the story exfoliates through these interleaved time periods, I like that word, exfoliates, as stories we tell in our heads aren't linear, it also shows us the crushing wages of time. Also, the story may be ironic take on the proverb, "Truth is the daughter of time," as here time may be obscuring or revising truth, most clearly in the form of Alzheimer's. Note all the imagery of mists and of darkness. He also has an observation. "Finally, am I crazy, but were the older kids playing with the boy's bike at night in the Devil's Den? I rewatched it and it looked like it, but felt too much of a bombshell clue to show so early." I think they were, but I didn't take it as like, I just thought it's like this kid ditched a bike there and these older kids were just fucking with it like they would.
Yeah. You're not gonna ride your bike back into the deep woods.
Right, and leave it there overnight when the kids show up with their mare Joanna and their right. shitty Mad Dog Bartles and James stuff and drinking Robitussin, Dimetapp. Like, your bike's not gonna survive that. You gotta know that as a kid.
I think the theme of time is an interesting one to, you know, pair with memory because they're intertwined naturally. I haven't thought about it, and I'm probably not smart enough to understand exactly where they're going with that. Or if I am smart enough, I'm certainly not well read enough to understand the Robert Penn Warren stuff.
Same here.
Not like Nick Pizzolatto does. I'm sure he's
right.
You know, a scholar when it comes to that stuff. So
recite that by heart.
Yeah. But I think there are some interesting themes at play, and that probably warrants a closer examination.
Yeah, no, I appreciate people bringing it to us. Daniel J. pointed out, he's one of the ones that pointed out that he thinks Ali's character doesn't read the book because of his dyslexia. Mm. So credit there. Sean G., I know the general consensus is the West Memphis 3 will be more or less a red herring. However, I'd like to put forth a correction and a theory. My ears perked up when you briefly went over the West Memphis 3 case. You mentioned when new DNA evidence was introduced, the conviction was overturned. What actually happened was once the DNA evidence came to light, the defense attorneys started pushing for a new trial. Arkansas then allowed the convicted men to enter an Alford plea. An Alford plea is more or less an admission of guilt, usually including a deal suspending the prison sentence met out at the original trial. The state gets to close the case and doesn't need to spend tax dollars on a new trial, and the convict walks free, albeit with a murder conviction on the record.
No.
How wonderful that we live in a society where if we get wrongfully convicted of a crime, we have a chance of getting out after a couple of decades, and as long as the state is too lazy, afraid of embarrassment to retry you. All this, mind you, happens while the real offender is out there walking free. I agree. It's great. It's great. Now, here's my theory. What if the state ends up deciding to offer the convicted unknown person in the 90s an Alford plea? This would not only close the case in the official level, but also weigh on Hayes tremendously, especially if he had doubts during the original conviction. He'd be stuck in his limbo where he's constantly thinking about this case, and he won't be able to work on any of the official level as the case would be closed. Introducing that weird wrinkle in our justice system would reflect the real world rather nicely while pulling our main protagonist in a very difficult position. So I guess my only the motivations I don't think there, because it doesn't seem like he had doubts based on the 90s stuff we've seen before. It seems like he felt true blue and was kind of offended that they were undoing his police work in the 1980s conviction. So definitely the idea that, oh God, we've got the wrong person, or I put the wrong person away and the other person is out there. But like, I don't think that doubt was eating him for those 10 years. That's the only thing I think as has overturned it in any of this theory in the last week.
Yeah.
What do you think? Alford, please. Alford, please for everybody.
Maybe I look at, like, you know, the thematic stuff they're doing with Tom and the Native American guy from Vietnam. They both speak of, you know, being stuck in a situation that they can't leave, and they also can't stay, you know, can't stay awake, but can't sleep, that kind of thing. And putting Hayes in that position in the 90s, I think, would be a very interesting thing to do, and could, you know, potentially be the thing that leads to whatever. I get the impression that there was strife in the marriage before Amelia died.
Yeah.
But I'm not actually sure why.
Well, we saw some strife, but this could be a flash in a pan strife.
Right. This could be the beginning.
This could be red herring strife.
Red herring strife.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would think, like, putting him in a similar situation to understand Tom better would be interesting.
Right. Right. Do you think that they're setting up Woodward to be the patsy? Because I can't imagine a scenario, unless they actually have hard, concrete evidence that he abducted the children. Like, you know, he finds their clothes in his locker or some shit like that. Like, I don't think Hayes would ever believe that he did this.
Yeah.
But, I could see him being wrongfully convicted. It seems like whoever they wrongfully convict, Hayes at least has to be kind of convinced. But that doesn't also line up with them fucking a good detective. Like, how would they? I'm really curious to see how Hayes is ultimately feels vindicated in the conviction, but also wronged.
Yeah.
Because so maybe that's how Roland gets the credit for blowing the case wide open, and they
when really like he everything we see in this episode is Luke Wayne is pushing this investigation forward. He's the guy who's tracking down everything that leads anywhere.
But you look at all these missteps, maybe deliberate, maybe it's incompetence, maybe it's a cover up from on high. If they shove all those mistakes onto Hayes and then give all of Hayes credit to. I could see how that would elevate, you know, Roland and piss off Hayes, and but still have him be fundamental. All of his police work is right. I don't know. That'd be interesting. Sean also suggests that if we were interested in West Memphis 3, there is a documentary called Paradise Lost, and it's a trilogy of documentaries that were filmed over in 1996, 2000, 2011. And it's like it gives a really good comprehensive kind of like coverage of the case. And honestly, that's. I don't like true crime, but I do like true crime that illuminates problems within the justice system and kind of like and so this kind of stuff where like analyzing miscarriages of justice, I think is way more interesting than just, oh, yeah, here's a crazy serial killer that wore people's skin and here's all the lurid details of it, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So I actually might take a poke at that. All right. Moving on to Clay. Westfinger is based on this is one of the legion of boots we have on the ground. Westfinger is based on a town I grew up in called West Fork, which is located about 10 minutes south of Fayetteville. I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly because I got multiple corrections.
Yeah,
it's not Fayetteville at all. Futtville. About 20 minutes northeast of Devil's Den State Park. I have no idea why they couldn't call it just West Fork, but apparently there's an issue getting permission. What? I mean, that makes me want to set a murder in our shithole town of Mooresville.
Uh-huh.
Like, just try to keep me from using the name more. I'll call it Lesville. Is that what you want? Is that what you want? God, I want to write a true crime and set it there. Because, like, yeah, what the fuck? You can't use a real location to set something? What the hell? Has anyone told Stephen King this?
I guess not.
Because all this shit is clearly set in a very particular time and place. I don't know. That seems crazy, but... I don't know. It's the same thing, I guess, they did with the fictional town and Sharp Objects. It seems like they had exactly the kind of place that they wanted, that they just gave it some other name. So,
yeah.
Because also, I guess it could also be a lazy way of, you know, instead of having to research a town and get all the street names correct, you can just like, it's like this town. Wink.
Right.
All right, moving on. Chelsea, want to point out one conspiracy theory that you may not know involving the West Memphis 3. All right, Mr. Bojangles, are you ready?
Oh,
there's
okay.
A suspect that has never been found is commonly referred to as Mr. Bojangles. He was described as an African-American male who showed up disoriented and covered in blood in Bojangles in West Memphis the night the three disappeared. Bojangles, I guess, is a restaurant.
Yeah, I read through the Wikipedia article. I was like, oh, boy, that's an offensive name for this person. And then I realized, oh, okay, he's in the Bojangles restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. But it is. It's a very kind of Jeepers Creepers kind of Mr. Bojangles.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a thread on Reddit and she refers me to, but there's other sources. She thinks that the trash man, which I think she's referring to as Woodward here, reminds her of the mysterious Mr. Bojangles because they're both men living outside the norms of their small towns. I've always heard Mr. Bojangles described as a vagrant or homeless person. Or could Ali's character end up being a Bojangles killer type of type killer of the boy? I just thought I'd throw it out there since it may have influenced Pizzolatto. So she also gave me the definitive pronunciation guide. It's Fayetteville. So okay. Thank you for that, because all of our boots on the ground in Arkansas was taking me to task for that. Hmm. I mean, the similarities there of the men being outside. This guy's kind of like described as a vagrant bum Native American, and the other guy was a vagrant homeless African American. I could totally see that jiving, but also I'm trying to keep Nick's caution of these are not one to one parallels at heart too.
Yeah,
but I mean, for that, you know, like he could have the literal same cast of characters, but just with a slightly different outcome. So it could literally be like the West, this Memphis 3 with the twist that some, like, it was Bojangles instead of the other kids, and it would be, wouldn't that be like not one to one?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's also interesting to, you know, combine that Mr. Bojangles theory with what we learned in this episode about, you know, the mysterious sedan with the black man and the white woman. that with the man with the scar and the white suit, like that could be a loose interpretation of the Mr. Bojangles stuff.
Mm.
But I'm not sure.
Joseph,
because it was a thing that was never investigated, right? Much like the Mr. Bojangles.
The Bojangles angle, yeah. The Bojangles angle, not investigated. Joseph says, the dad used to work at a school bus factory, and school bus drivers would know all about where the kids live and the comings and goings of the parents. Plus, there's a lingering shot of a school bus in a second episode. Is there any there?
With a brown Mercedes next to it. Seriously.
I don't think that, like, in, so speaking of my hometown, we had like a bus motor pool, but it wasn't a bus factory. It's like where all the buses were kept, mm-hmm. and they were maintained and their oils changed and their engines were worked on and shit. Like, I think this is an actual, they manufacture parts that are shipped out to repair school buses and whatnot. So I don't think that these people have any kind of contact with bus drivers or anything like that. That's what I got. They're a machine shop, not like the motor pool for a community busing service.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think there's anything there. Sorry, Joseph. Zach. I think this is actually BIPAC Zach.
Oh, okay. Hey,
so,
Zach.
Hey there. One thing you guys mentioned in the podcast about the moon phase in 1980s reminded me of something else that caught my ear in the episode. Right when the kids got off on their bikes, Scoot is in the garage working on his car, listening to a baseball game. Given the time of year, it can only be the World Series. The issue is the 1980s World Series didn't make it to November. The last game was on October 21st when the moon was 95% full. I still think the most likely excuse is they started writing it set in late October and then changed it to get the Halloween doll giving in. But with the story focusing on unreliable narrators, who knows? Man, this kind of sucks because the more chronological inconsistencies there are, the less I think that the moon theory holds water. Unless they're just really leaning into the unreliable narrator and this is all supposed to reward the off-screen detective work that we're doing.
Yeah, it's tough because I really feel, you know, what Amelia's talking about with time and her interpretation of the story, that we are of it and in it and cannot extricate ourselves from it, because you can say, oh, well, this is West. This is not West Fork. This is West Folly.
Middle finger.
This is West Fuck. And you can change all the street names or just not get the street names right. But you know what you can't do?
Uh-huh.
Is say that this was Billy Goat the 8th of 1980, and it doesn't have an analog in the real world, so, you know, I can make stuff up. No, we're stuck in time. Like, this has to have a setting and a time and a place. So.
And the thing is, here's the thing that's the flashing neon sign on all this. Pizzolatto's gone through two fucking seasons of this. He knows how the internet works. If he says that there's a moon phase and gives the fucking date, he knows that people are going to look at the calendar.
He should, yeah.
So, like, and they're like, if he wanted to set, he could have moved his shit around. Like, I don't know. If he just had to hammer this to make Halloween work, I don't know. It seems like he's setting himself to make a lot of people angry. So I kind of think there is something there. But then again, this is the guy that put up a whole bunch of spiral kid drawings in Woody Harrelson's home during a season that was all about spiral pictographs
and spiral birds
and denied there any intent. He's like, oh, well, that's just a set dresser. They just had some pictures of kids drawing hanging out there. So, like,
and that turned out to be true.
So, like, sometimes shit happens or Pizzolatto's a liar. Either way, it leaves us in a squirmy position where you can't deny that there's weird stuff happening to margins, but it also could be just an accident because you're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where that leaves us. We'll see. Professor Jason E, who is also an Arkansas native that has more information on the setting for us, has a few things to say. He says the Northwest Arkansas, the NWA region, is really nothing like the setting of Ozark in Missouri. First, West Finger is only a few miles away from the corridor of the cities of Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, and Bentonville. Or is that Beantonville? Like, is there some kind of crazy pronunciation for that, too?
Yes.
Rogers and Beantonville. In those cities, you have the University of Arkansas and the headquarters for Tyson Foods, J.B. Hunt, and, of course, Walmart.
The university and those companies bring in a considerable amount of money in the area, as well as folks like myself who work there. And don't get me wrong, Arkansas gets rural in a hurry when you get past these cities, and the main story takes place 30 years ago. But the middle of Missouri is about as backwoods as a place can get, with not much to see except for Jesus, fireworks stores, and porn shops. Shots fired, Missouri. Mm. Arkansas. Arkansas. The little Calvin pissing on your state logo. Finally, this is kind of interesting thing for me, but the 1990s timeline of True Detective will partially take place on the campus here in the University of Arkansas. How do I know this? Because I teach in the classroom pretty much every semester, shit. And my office is right below where they were filming.
Spoilers.
It was something of a big deal when they came to film here last year, I imagine. Yeah, and spoiler alert, some of this is going to be set in the University of Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that blew the lid off no, it didn't change anything. Thanks for that report. Appreciate it. Brian S., Texas Sandman. I enjoyed this episode and the weaving of the three timelines into one narrative, and has been good for me so far. I feel like it all flows together well, and there's enough physical markers on our main characters distinguishing the three eras. I'm never getting lost or questioning where we are in the story. I gotta say, yeah, especially Mahershala's wig, like the high rise versus the low rise, that's doing some work.
I need that.
I do. I need because that otherwise, hair. Him and Amelia look the fucking same, man.
Her hair is also much better in the 90s. Much better.
Well,
oh, yeah.
This is the 80s, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the 80s had bad hair.
It's, yeah, bad lots of things. A little 70s hangover going on in the 80s, we're all being honest with each other. Brian continues, there seems to be quite a few similarities with season one. The perceived schism between the two detectives after initially working well together and solving a big case. Bad home life fueled by distrust and alcohol for one of the detectives, getting the gang back together after years apart to finally solve the case for reals. I'm enjoying everything, but if more and more story points are mirrored, I can see myself feeling a bit cheated. What do you think about that? Like, to me, I didn't have a problem with The Force Awakens. Yeah, it was essentially Star Wars done all over again to a slavish degree, but I was in the mood for that. I kind of am in the mood for a by-the-numbers True Detective, you know, triple mystery inside each other romp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can go for that. I'm I guess less focused on that than some people, but you know, reasonably would be.
Yeah. As far as the initial investigation part of the case goes, I'm assuming that a lot of groundwork was and is done by the local police department. That would include canvassing, field interview, surveillance. I'm curious how involved Wayne and Roland would be in the bulk of these activities. Would it make sense that they are following up on things that they deem worthy of further investigation and maybe not talking to every neighbor? I could see some of the local PD missing things in the reports and maybe not considering some information as relevant to the case. Do you have any insight as to how involved the two True Detectives are in the perceived mistakes that 2015 True Crime Lady is bringing up? I feel like my idea is like this is being fucked by on high. That, like, there is, like, Roland and Hayes are not the only detectives obviously working on this. You got the FBI. You got some of the, like, you know, non-detectives just doing grunt work. And I think that there is, like, leads are being divvied up and filed to different detectives based on maybe some nefarious intent. So, like, I do think that Hayes was kind of shut out of a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be that he was in on it and he's just forgotten.
Right.
Like, he falsified a bunch of police reports and just forgot that he did it.
That's what I always go back to, is how much of this can we trust?
Yeah.
You know, how much of what we're seeing should we believe?
Yeah. Finally, says, I'm sure you've looked this up or been informed, but Mamie Gummer is the Gummer we see in the show, older sister to Grace from Mr. Robot. I'll say that the makeup on her is great. She looks super haggard and worn, but not in a fakey way. Very natural. Holy shit, Brian. Did you just light up?
Take that, Mamie.
Poor Mamie Gummer.
Boom.
You're nailing that haggard dish rag look, girl.
God.
Doesn't look affected at all. Jesus, Brian. Let's kind of let's have some comedy here in the podcast. Damn. Moving on to Josh. He wants to discuss our buddy Joanna Robinson's theory of the case she posted in her Vanity Fair column.
Shit, I haven't seen this.
Oh, you haven't?
No. Enlighten me.
I think she's been huffing the psychosphere.
She does this. This is her thing. She like runs with a theory that seems pretty wild at the beginning of a season. Sometimes she's right.
Yeah. No. I mean, and also, so some of this stuff is paraphrased from her podcast that she does with her partner. And I didn't have time to listen to it, so I just like looked at a transcript. So some of this could be tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
Like in the same way that we kind of run with theories sometimes. So I in the same way that I kind of like propound the Varys as a mermaid theory on Game of Thrones and Roose Bolton as a vampire. It's like, it's a fun way to fuck with the text, but I don't really, really believe it's there. So I don't know. I'm just, but this is getting a lot of time share. It's one of the many Amelia is the true killer.
Okay.
Theories.
Lay it on me, because I'm dying to know.
So here's how Joanna lays this out. And I'm only going to get like halfway through this theory. If you want to read the rest, I'm putting it in the show notes. She looked uncomfortable when they were joking about Wayne looking her up in the police system. Evidence.
Amelia did?
Yeah, these are just bullet point evidence.
Okay. I would be uncomfortable if somebody looked me up in a police system, and I don't think I'm in the system.
And if it's a handsome man and you're dating a person, like there's like, a lot of awkwardness and uncomfortable seems to be just Amelia feeling out whether it's wise to engage romantically with this man.
Yeah.
She was involved in Black Panthers, and that organization endorsed violence, and some of its leaders were brought up on murder charges.
Against children, specifically.
So the murder, she's a murdering Black Panther.
Sure. Yep.
She talks about liking to put on new personalities and personas to try out on strangers.
Okay, that's slightly weird.
Yeah. Slightly. Yeah, it's quirky.
Yeah.
It's quirky. She acts uncomfortable when Wayne reveals that he's a professional manhunter. Not the fact that a man is just a hunter of men. Like, that's a wild thing.
It is a wild thing.
Yeah.
For a school teacher to encounter. Yeah.
It's just like I've had conversations with people who have like soldiers who have shot at and killed other people, and it is a wild thing.
It is, yeah.
Like it's a lot that like you can either relate, you're either in that club or you're not. So like I think it's fine to be kind of like have a thrill or a shiver go through you when discussing with someone that is just that's taken a life. It's a hell of a thing. A murder helping with the investigation is an Agatha Christie trope.
Okay.
She understands children would thus be easy to thus easy for her to manipulate them. That sounds good, except for children just notoriously easy to manipulate. You don't have to be a master manipulator to manipulate children.
You just need candy in your pocket.
That's one of the reasons it's so heinous.
Right.
Right.
You need a panel van.
Yeah.
And a bucket of candy on Halloween. You're done.
Yeah. They're like it's like, you know, hens and foxes, except for the hens are even more defenseless than they are. They have no guile at all. Okay. She likes to try on different personas, and it's going to be wind up revealed that she is in fact the white suit wearing scarred face man. Or
whoa.
They're a racially flipped version with her and her boyfriend. Her boyfriend's applying the shiny new brown sedan.
Okay.
All right. One of the poems she reads provides the title for Agatha Christie's Endless Night story, which features a protagonist who's also the narrator of the story that in the end reveals that they themselves are the murderer that you've been reading about the entire time. So like she's kind of protagonist, but she's not the narrator. She's not the POV for sure.
I've seen people speculating that like, the end of Amelia's book said, "Oh, and I'm the murderer. Right. I did it." I'm like,
"Is this like an O.J. Simpson?
This got published, right?
Yeah, right. If I did it,
and then Wayne, when he reads it, is going to go, "Oh my god!" Now maybe there's a breadcrumb in there that Wayne
maybe
would have insight into that
maybe
other people wouldn't. But.
So what's her motive, right? Why would she do it?
Yeah,
because just like she said
for
in episode
book.
One, she's bored of teaching. She wants to write. And why not commit murders and abduct children so you can write the true crime thriller of literary history
this,
and make bank, baby.
God, this kind of reflects negatively on Nick Pizzolatto, right? A man who has written a crime thriller about kidnapped and murdered children.
Oh, yeah.
Should we be looking into his past?
Of course
we
should.
Or his present, or maybe even his future?
Of course you should. if not... Just looking at any of his interviews should let you know that the man needs to be looked at under a microscope. Like he's
fair.
He's got a certain affect that, you know, he's either going to be a successful television crime writer and director, or he's a serial killer. It's a very binary
perhaps
choice we have here, folks.
Both, much like Amelia.
Much like Amelia. This kind of neatly explains some of the mystery within a mystery vibes the show gives and some of the things that look like denial and cover up on the part of Wayne. Okay. There's a lot more to this. Like I said, I'm about halfway through, but like
it's a lot like this. A lot of it is you have to believe that all discomfort Amelia experiences with mm-hmm. Wayne is because she knows she has killed these children or abducted them, and she is leading the detectives on a very cat and mouse game to write this murder mystery, and that doesn't seem compelling. And Occam's razor is over there clearing its throat saying, what if she's just nervous about whether she should get involved? I mean, there's so many different ways. Like, she's helping this police officer. Is it ethical to get involved professionally? Mm-hmm. You know, is it, and compromise herself like that way? She's got a relationship with another man is complicating things. They are not in tune at all politically, mm-hmm. or even like, and like politics is one thing, but like met, like maybe not even morally and ethically. Yeah. Like, when is it right to kill people? What is it? When is it right to stand up for your rights? And how do you fight for them? Like, there's a lot of big divisions there. So yeah. I didn't, but you know, again, maybe Joanna's right. Maybe she's trolling. If this sounds interesting at all, check out the show notes and see her full thoughts. And that is our podcast for the week.
Nice.
We can be reached at truedetective@baldmove.com. There's always a forums, forums.baldmove.com. If you'd like to talk this stuff over with your fellow fans, we always reserve the right to come back later in the week if something big, some big theory drops and develops. Other than that, we will definitely see you back next Tuesday for the next episode. Now, in previous years past, episode 4 has been kind of a big deal in True Detective. It's mm-hmm. kind of like the penultimate episode of The Wire. Like, lots of fireworks. You had the big one take, trap house raid in the first season. The second one, was that the Lodge?
Might have been. Shootout? I don't remember.
I can't remember, but there's always been like some kind of action packed whammy bammy thing, and we're wondering if this will keep the trends going. So we will see mm-hmm. next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Bye.